Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to another episode of the Talking About Platforms podcast. Today we have two new faces on the podcast. The first one is one that you will see or hear again from time to time, which is Volker Stocker, our new co-host, who is running the Berlin squad together with myself. Hi, Volker. First time on the Talking About Platforms podcast. Great to have you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure and honor to be part of this wonderful project. Thank you.
Great to have you. And our second face and second voice for all the listeners is Payal Arora. We're excited to welcome you as well, Payal. You're a professor of inclusive AI cultures at the Utrecht University and a digital anthropologist by training. You spent like decades on the ground researching what you call the majority world. That's the 80% of the global population living outside the quote-unquote developed West. You've been recognized. I saw this and I thought that's a fun quote, the next billion champion by Forbes. And you've consulted a variety of big organizations, United Nations, companies like Spotify, and helped them understand how people live with technology beyond the West. And then I'd like to mention two of your exciting books that we also used for prepping the conversation. One is The Next Billion Users. And then your latest one, From Pessimism to Promise. Payal, welcome to Talking About Platforms.
Thanks so much. Looking forward to this conversation.
Great. Payal, we always open with the same, like, say, pair of questions. And I'd also like to address them to you. One is, what is a platform to you? And then the second one, how did you end up studying platforms?
Sure. So, you know, I would say a platform is basically an interface, an intermediary. And I think we over-romanticize that it is something novel. It's something, you know, extremely disruptive. We've, as long as we are a society where we engage with each other, we've always had intermediaries, right? So human and technical, oftentimes together, right? And social. So there are people who serve as intermediaries and in concert with technology. So a platform really manifests the way in which we see intermediating between people, and that requires us to attend to the politics of intermediaries, right? Because there's no such thing as a neutral engagement between people and institutions, between institutions themselves, and at a local to a global level, right? And in terms of studying this, it's basically, if you're interested in people, you're interested in where they inhabit, where they find their home. And increasingly, as you mentioned, I've been studying the next billion users. And for those who don't know what the hell that is, which is very reasonable because it's one of those catchphrases. It's basically a couple of years ago, this term was coined by the tech companies, particularly to capture the market. And particularly when I talk about markets, I'm talking about the data economy coming from the global south, because a lot of major changes happened about a decade ago. One is most people gain access to mobile phones, many of them smartphones, and it was happening at an exponential rate, as well as data plans became increasingly affordable. And so that was a major game changer. So, for example, India, a decade ago, used to be one of the most expensive places for data, and then has become now the cheapest in the world, right? So what this means is you had this influx of young people coming online for the first time, and they are engaging with these platforms, but it's through these platforms, they're getting to know the world. And not only that, the world is getting to know them. They are the next turn users. And, you know, this is very important because they are shaping the algorithm. They're shaping the nature of the culture of the space. And it helps to also know that 90% of young people in the world today live in the global south. 90. 85% of the entire world population lives in the global south. So they're not an add-on. They are literally the fabric of these platforms in the way in which they're constituted and the way in which they're becoming. Because after all, technologies are always in the becoming, right? So yeah, that's basically my take on this.
Wonderful introduction, Payal. But let's move into the first theme, talk about digital optimism and pessimism, because I think what you just said, and basically who are the new users of the internet, and then basically the young and in the global south, that makes an important, I think, aspect of your work. So if you follow the academic literature or even the mainstream conversation, I would say the picture is slightly or often bleak. Zuboff and her surveillance capitalism, Noble and her algorithms that reproduce racial oppression, headlines warn that AI will kill our jobs, undermine democracy, pose existential risk. Now, there's a bunch of serious scholars that raise serious issues and legitimate concerns, but your work makes an argument that these narratives may not just be incomplete, they are shaped by a very particular vantage point or position in the world, and that position comes with blind spots. You also have coined the term, and this was a Plamadiso talk you gave, I think, 2 years ago, doomsday divas. And you emphasize the need to recognize trade-offs, right? And the need to balance those. So I had a look at your paper, The Privilege of Pessimism, before this event. And I'm paraphrasing a bit here. You basically argue that the West is suffering from a kind of pessimism paralysis towards the digital. And you argue that this despair is itself a privilege. It's a privilege for those who can afford to live with despair. Now, meanwhile, as you said, a large share of the world's internet users, young people across the global south, who have come online through cheap smartphones, affordable data plans, you just mentioned that, they have a different outlook. They are, as I think you put it, full of hope, fueled perhaps by something that is more of a pragmatic optimism. Now, from your 2 decades of research and fieldwork, you've worked on you made studies in Brazil, India, I guess, China, South Africa, and beyond. This is, what have you learned about how the majority of the world's users actually experience online platforms and AI? And what does that teach us about the blind spots in how we, as a research community, have studied the platform economy?
Yeah, no, thank you. And, you know, I really appreciate you capturing my argument in a nutshell so we can actually take this even further, right? So absolutely, I am very harsh about this very prominent group of scholars coming on board and have become invested in this pessimism bias, which is inscribed in the way in which we think, we feel towards technologies, and how human beings today, particularly in the West, are positioning us against tech. So the manifestation of agency is about refusal, it's about resistance. And so thereby, you don't see technologies as part of a solution, as part of the fact that it can circumvent or even address some chronic issues. And we inadvertently are romanticizing what was, right? And so if you think about it, you know, the people at the forefront, right? I mean, one of the things I call out is these double standards amongst these prominent voices across board, whether it's on data colonialism or surveillance capitalism, because the framing is these are privileged actors who are out there professing a very deterministic outlook of how technology has, as Nicole Rees says, has made us lose all control over our data and ourselves. That sounds very existential and it sounds very hopeless, right? If you read Caste, one of the most prominent books that Oprah has celebrated as a book of the century, and she talks about oppression and in her, I reviewed the entire 300-something page book, right? And basically, she doesn't barely mentions class, socioeconomic class, right? And she has an extraordinary position. She's based in, you know, the U.S. And by being, you know, African-American doesn't make you necessarily a default person who is oppressed, right? If particularly, would you say Oprah is oppressed, right? So, I mean, so I think we've lost our stamina to engage with socioeconomics because it's an uncomfortable variable. It was there in the 70s and 80s and it conveniently got dropped. And we started to put identity as at the forefront. But when you put economics, socioeconomics at play, because the next billion users, they're mostly resource-constrained people. And then you realize how perverse it is to tell people who have very limited resources, who don't have jobs at their disposal, that, you know what, you should be thinking about, you know, how the digital is your enemy. But on the contrary, let's come up with the fact that we have 3.5 billion, I mean, million people who are refugees who see that the digital is their only way oftentimes to connect with their loved ones around the world. It's their only way to carve a way in which they can make a living because people have forgotten them. They're sitting in camps. They're not temporary. That's their livelihood. That's their place of stay. Potentially generations, whether it's in Turkey, whether it's a camps in Brazil. We actually worked for a year in with Venezuelan refugees in Brazil, and basically with the UNHCR, they were desperate to opt in, not opt out, because it was their single most powerful way to humanize themselves and humanize themselves to the world. So they were doing it through, the creator economy trajectories, like eyebrow tutorials on YouTube, to, you know, talking about what religion meant to them and how it helped them cope to be inspirational to others. All people who are homosexuals in Uganda, and, you know, it's worth remembering that 65 countries in the world today criminalize being homosexual, right? And so again, the privilege is about also being in a liberal democracy, which is less than 14% of the world. And that also is debatable, right? Would you call the US now a liberal democracy, or Hungary, or any of these states, right? So it's still that's actually shrinking. So in that respect, the digital is so much more enabling because the reality is much more confrontational. So people are willing to take the risk to go online, not because they're naive, but because it's their only way to cope with these extraordinary circumstances. And I can give you examples upon examples. And the most visceral right now is Iranians. I mean, I'm actually engaging with Iranian scholars, Iranian activists. And for them, it's a lifeline. Try telling them how the digital is extractive in a time when the regime is massacring them. And, you know, nonstop, and the digital is the only way in which they can get the message heard. And look at the creativity that's involved in, you know, really like pushing their cause from the Women Life Freedom Movement. And you see the amazing amount of enthusiasm. And what are they calling for? They're calling for the right to being online, the right to being visible and heard. So the privilege is on multiple levels. Socioeconomic level, it's also the fact that we take for granted our liberal democracies, particularly in Europe. We have become so lazy in our thinking. We have forgotten what it's like to be at war. We've forgotten what it's like to be unstable. And we've forgotten what it's like, you know, post-World War II, because we've had the privilege of peace and democracy for so long. And we need to change our mindset, otherwise we're really screwed, right? And I do hold these academics culprit because they are basically creating a pessimism paralysis amongst our young people who I am engaging with on an everyday level, who feel extraordinarily hopeless, who get into burnouts, depression, and they start to ask, and also, how, in what ways are these people getting oppressed? Which basically is reproducing the same trope and losing an open-minded question about how are people actually engaging with these technologies, which make things much more complicated. So, and lastly, mainstream media takes their cues from these experts. So that to me has created a sort of a media infrastructure of pessimism, you know, which is consolidated by academia, mainstream media, and thereby, you know, the followers who feel safe to dismiss technology as they use technologies and they express their disdain towards their thousands of followers on all these social media. And that's another last point, is the double standards and the hypocrisies. We are literally on, you know, what are we talking on, right? Right, like Zoom, we're on Teams, we're using all these big tech, and then we are professing and advocating the rest of the world, the global south, to be using alternative tech, because that's, you know, the right thing to do with our righteousness. So until and unless we have given up everything in big tech, we have no right to be professing a different kind of standard for the rest of the world.
Maybe like now focusing a bit on the optimism part and looking ahead. How can we in, let's quote unquote, the West, address, I think, often our valid concerns about like platforms and now with the increasing use of AI without like accidentally, so to say, gatekeeping these tools for these billion users elsewhere? So what is basically the conversation that you wish for and maybe see here and there in, be it big tech or also regulation, to make sure we don't leave this unaddressed and don't like stay in this like level of paternalism?
Yeah, so one of the most important things is that we have to recognize we're on the same page, actually, in many ways. You know, all of us, what do we want when we talk about sovereignty? Absolutely. Silicon Valley, you know, companies, you know, need to basically be sidelined. We absolutely need to create much more for European infrastructure, European autonomy. We need to have it citizen-centered, you know, people-centered. We need to think about it as planet-centered because it's not sustainable. All of these things, you know, if we think about the end goal, we're on the same page. And this is something I keep reminding people. It's not people like, oh, so are you saying that it's okay that big tech does what it does? I was like, it's not a whataboutism, right? It's more about how do we achieve a common goal? And it's not through regulation alone. And the European mindset is, you know, all stick, no carrot. There's almost no mention of incentives. And when we start to think about incentives, we start to ask, why do people, you know, despite giving them public digital infrastructures, you know, despite providing these state options, seek for these proprietary platforms? This is happening around the world. This has happened decades ago with France failed to come up with their, you know, Google kind of state-driven, you know, search engine, right? Yeah. And they usually, the way it ends up being is that, oh, people, it's the people's fault. I mean, they don't know what's good for them, right? And I also sit on the Indian government's advisory board for the digital economy, and we've built something called the Indian Stack, right? The digital public infrastructure, what Europe has been trying to do for decades. And India went ahead with a fraction of its resources, which, by the way, is what the most powerful counter tool, which also Europe is emulating now, called the Eurostack, right? But they're also maybe inadvertently copying the same kind of problems. Both contexts, it's well worth remembering, in the age of the European-India trade deal, is really important to process. Because what that basically means is that you have invested enormous amounts of money in this digital public infrastructures, which theoretically can allow any entrepreneur, any person to build their own application without paying the mafia fee of 30% to Android, iOS. And the data stays within these countries. It is also open source. All of that sounds good, except people are not using it as much oftentimes because it's not user-friendly. Why do we dismiss user-friendliness? And what does that actually mean? It's like a side note. You know, look at all our research projects in academia. It's when it comes to the social aspect, because I get invited on a nonstop basis to be on part of all sorts of grants. The social angle to computational solutions to the counterforce of Silicon Valley's big tech is, let's look at the ethics involved and regulation. Ethics, we have 100,000 manifestos, please, not another, okay? Like, no more normatives. I mean, it's extraordinarily a snooze fest. Second is, you know, in terms of regulation, sure, regulation is great if you can enforce it. Otherwise, don't waste my time, right? So let's look at providing also incentives and why can people, how do we get people to use this? So understand what are the obstacles? What is it that we can enable so they actually, because people want to get on the bandwagon. You think they want to use Amazon? You think they want to use, and people are getting more and more pissed off with the American way of thinking and their bullying tactics, right? But give them a legitimate choice. Don't give them this clunky, extraordinary, unhelpful tool to use. And then they were like, I don't have this much time in the day to figure these platforms out. And it's not rocket science. It's just a matter of channeling your resources, giving real emphasis to incentives, and taking the everyday person, the so-called user, seriously. Because that, in the end of the day, is how we are going to scale and embed these digital public infrastructures and genuinely serve as a counterforce to dismiss the big tech from Silicon Valley. Then we all will be happy and we'll be on the same page. But if we're not doing this, these smart tactics, so in which case we are very, very paternalistic, you know. And this is also coming from the fact that I sit also on the e-governance board of the UN and many other kinds of these, you know, organizations which still think it's like they're stuck in time from the 60s, you know. Like, how do we, you know, deliver the solutions to all these victims and beneficiaries? They're not victims and beneficiaries. Have more faith in your people and see what they can do with these technologies, but do make their life easier. And this cuts across sectors. It cuts across institutions. You just need to get our act together.
And acknowledge that they're like human and they will use the tech like everyone else would, right? Like you intend them to do. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's different groups. There's a difference between someone who's in their 70s using it. And so there's a generational cultural, need to understand there's a cross-cultural, like in terms of, you know, how do people use it based on their vantage point, in terms of their needs, you know, are you a parent? Are you someone who is, you know, trying to get welfare? So it's socioeconomics is so key. We do need to really put class into the center of our conversations. Otherwise, you're going to have another one of those Brexit kind of notions. And you'd say, oh, what idiots, right? So, I mean, honestly, I know I'm not mincing any words. I'm not making many friends when I say this, but I am so fed up about wasting our resources, wasting our time. And I have been talking about this for the last 2 years, and I seem to keep, you know, confronting the same damn discourse in mainstream media. And then oftentimes they'll ask me this question. So can Europe learn from the global south? And I translate that saying, you're basically saying, can you learn from 85% of the world or 90% of the world's population, a young population? And you're what? A middle-aged person? And Europe is a declining demographic. So you don't want to learn from young people, right? And these are global platforms. So you have global ambitions, but very parochial approaches, which basically fit your village, right? So that's the core of the problem that we need to address, is that we need to reform our mindsets in the way we even structure the grants. Any kind of incentive mechanism that's coming from Europe is so outdated. Like, for example, grants from Europe about how Europe can design generative AI technologies, and then you bring on African partners to disseminate it. How is that not problematic? you know, because they're not seeing Europe as the innovators. They've already innovated in their own, they innovate, like look at Latin GPT, right? Which just got released yesterday. Like, they're not waiting for Europe to come up with a solution. They think Europe is a decade behind. So it's such a joke. I mean, this is basically the arrogance of Europe that thinks that they can design for the rest of the world without listening to what's going on around the world, right? Which is oftentimes way ahead of them, whether it's in fintech, it's in, you know, EVs, it's in crypto, it's in any of those systems and digital public infrastructure. So we need to wake up.
That's very powerful points that you make. And I was wondering, I see there's a coexistence of dependency and agency. And my question would be, building on what you just said, what would you say would be a path towards digital sovereignty, meaning at the more jurisdictional, whatever level, but also at the individual level?
You know, I was talking to an Iranian scholar who told me, why do you keep talking about sovereignty? Because it's so arrogant to think that, you know, everybody enjoys a liberal democracy where state is got your back, right? We have to understand that majority of the world, the state doesn't have your back. Look at what's happening again in Iran. So one of the calls from the global south, because most states are really weaponizing technologies against them. So we need to come up with a global thinking again. Like what happened post-World War II, where we all woke up based on this extraordinary amount of debt, geopolitical mess, that we needed global institutions, global alliances, global thinking, including, by the way, the internet, right? Was a global undertaking where nobody owned the internet, right? And since then, we have gone into more and more of a localized approach. We almost celebrate and romanticize it, including what does sovereignty mean, right? I mean, we're talking about European sovereignty, Dutch sovereignty, German sovereignty. This, and it doesn't make sense. Like, I get like offsetting the big tech in Silicon Valley, but what we need to do is think in global terms of a critical set of actors that understands that liberal democracies need to be at the heart of the process and that any kind of power corrupts. So we need to come up with mechanisms where it is independent of any kind of shift in state politics, which means we have independent watchdogs, independent auditing bodies, because look at the US. Would you say the US is going to be the safeguard of, you know, this kind of system? They want to do America only. In fact, they are out to do America alone, because that's the direction it's going to go at, right? So I think it's really important to, when we talk about sovereignty, we need to place that in a larger project of what is a global vision for, you know, these infrastructures, these platforms, because the climate crisis is going to affect us all. This is a humanity problem. Right? This is a planetary problem. We need to think big and we need to think fast. So we absolutely need to get off this, you know, horse of arrogance and say, all right, Europe does have something that the rest of the world envies. And we cannot miss that opportunity, which is trust. We still, whatever shit is going on, we still have liberal democracies. We still evoke trust. And we need to step up and provide that, because if it is a European infrastructure, there's more for likelihood that they will safeguard the data. They will, you know, play it through. And I think that could be very important, but we don't see that. What we are offering is regulation to the rest of the world. And they're like, regulation, which is absolutely, so we just keep, you know, it's like a GDPR 4.0, right? Yay, AI Act. I mean, that's our expertise. That's really a shame, because we have not just regulation, we have institutions, good institutions, where we actually take people seriously, where we put people at the center. And, you know, it's not a buzzword. And it's like people around the world want to, you know, be like Europe. They're fighting But Europe cannot just stay with regulation alone. We need to be innovators, which means we need to understand incentives. We need to, you know, tap into entrepreneurial spirit, encourage creativity, allow spaces for the unknown, play with these spaces, and recognize our value, right?
You made very interesting points, and some of that I think resonates quite well with what the Draghi report, which you're aware of, probably said. Do you have any concrete suggestions how to move forward?
Yeah, so look, it's not so much that, oh, here's a three things you need to do, you know, like a self-help book, and you'll be good, right? It's more about we need to look at the devils in the details. We need to right now put resources into documenting innovations in which are reasonable, because enforcement of and policing is not actually working, because this sort of data extraction is happening. All right, there's too much money involved. What we do need to do is like understand, okay, data is currency, it has value, and rather than like do the lawsuits after lawsuits, we need to inscribe it as defaults, right? Where if you want to take the data, you need to pay. It's just a transactional, you know, entity. But let's make sure that small companies to medium-sized companies do not get to be punished, because they need to become the counterforce. We also need to create incentives for how they can become more responsible. It's not going to happen through the goodness of their heart. It needs to also have a win-win solution. We need to also think from their perspective. So, you know, we need to really get on board, and it really comes down to doing the work. I notice I don't tell Indian policymakers, it's like you're putting all this money into the tech, but there's almost no funding into the use cases. Do you not care about how it's being used? Don't you want it to be used in the way that actually will justify and rationalize why you've created this? And so then it won't be a surprise. You wonder, oh, gee, why are we, you know, why is this unsustainable? Because the users are not enough. Well, it comes down to taking them seriously, documenting, putting in resources, which means, oh, gee, it's not just economics. It requires like quality of the work, which of course humanities, oh, God forbid, may have to come into play, you know? Yeah. And also to train a new generation of researchers on how to do good work, which is not about, like I said, about just finger wagging and saying, oh, all big tech is evil, but understanding that, well, in this geopolitics, if we are going to be using them, we need to be able to instruct them on how to become responsible, which means that, so for example, if these big techs are creating gender AI safety protocols, how do they build that to counter, say, deepfake porn and misogynistic tweet, push them to also pay for that, right? So they need to do public research interest and not some sort of tech philanthropist ego extensions, which is about let's go to the Mars or moon or whatnot, right? So I think it just comes down to let's get boring, let's get real, let's accept that there's decisions that need to be made, and it's not based on ideal types. The, you know, when you look at conversations across board from education to the creative sector, they're like, you know, it's too bad. Like AI is going to replace the teacher. It could replace the creative. It can replace the healthcare worker. Hello, we don't have sufficient teachers. We don't have sufficient nurses. It's not replace. Or we have really poorly trained, particularly in the global south. But like what happens is people without a degree are serving as proxies for nurses and doctors. So it's not against an ideal good nurse or good teacher. It's often the absence of, it's often an incompetence, which is why people are going to these, you know, AI tools for therapy, for, you know, health, for their health, for education, etc. So understand that. And when you have this honest reckoning, it requires institutional change where technology is, like platforms are enablers, but not at the center of transformation. We still need to do the work at the institutional level, at a mindset level, and at a, you know, at a collaborative level of forming partnerships, which requires human to human, not platform to platform.
Yeah. I mean, we have covered, and you covered a lot of ground in your answers. And I think this is so much food for thought, and I hope inspires every listener here to reconsider also they maybe their more narrow view of some issues, and also to connect the dots in a way that we can have a much broader, more holistic understanding that we can more meaningfully ideate about ways forward. As you said, I mean, if we want to have collaboration, I think we must have also an incentive to collaborate. I mean, simple as that. And even in Europe, we have some fragmented interests, right? So it's, again, I mentioned a Draghi report, and you mentioned the bigger picture even. So I think there's a bunch of stuff that we can or need to work on. And I think I found this extremely inspiring so far. And I really think that the listeners will tremendously appreciate it. We'll follow up, of course, Payal, with you and your research. And I think they should. If I may ask, given what we discussed today, what's made you most hopeful recently? Because we talked a lot about pessimism, but also about optimism.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very hopeful that, you know, one of the best things that's happened since Trump came into office is that the world has become more unified. And we've stopped trying to pivot, or at least we are all on board trying to not go via US to each other. And I think that really matters, right? So you already see BRICS, like the Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, and China, all coming together to share open source models, innovators, which is, by the way, a massive market in itself. They're not even looking at the US model, right? You look at Latin America, this pan-Latin American initiative, amazing, right? They've literally realized ChatGPT and the like don't take their data seriously, is producing poor results because it's not in their languages and dialects. And they've literally created data sets and other kinds of platforms which are working for the pan-Latin American region, which is really important because they haven't pooled their resources together. And in 2 weeks, I'm going to South Africa, where they're doing very much this, and we are going for the stakeholder summit on how we can create a pan-African initiative for Africa, by Africa, around AI and innovation, right? And nobody is talking about the US. Nobody. It's more about what's happening in, you know, Nigeria, what's happening in Cape Town. It's also like more localized. What are folks in Cape Town doing, and what are folks in, you know, Pretoria doing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's at a local level. It's at a regional level. And how do we build standards? And this to in South Asia and Europe, it's happening across board. And I would love to see, and that's going to happen. You already see the Europe-India trade deal. You see many different kinds of arrangements. Geopolitics, whether Trump, you know, and Republicans or whatnot, other politics change or not, it doesn't matter. The U.S. has, you know, reminded us that any kind of extraordinary control and power and concentration in a one small group is a detrimental to our global security, to our planetary sustainability, and to the health and well-being of citizens. And so it's not really pertaining to the US. It could become Europe next, right? That we have to have this global appetite to think in these terms, and it's happening. And collaborations are the only way forward because, you know, we can't do it alone.
I think it's great to end our conversation on a positive note. So for me, like one thing I take many things away, but one thing I would like to mention is that in this like global digital tech conversation, it's very rarely black or white, right? It is there are trade-offs and there are nuances. I think one example that stuck to my mind that I talked about with Volker in prep for our conversation is the user innovation, right? On the one hand, user innovation using platforms can generate businesses and wealth and value. On the other hand, it shows maybe shortcomings of like state services and services that should be provisioned locally. Right, so you have these like two sides of the same coin, and I think we touched many, very interesting points and shed a new light that you have been doing for many years on this discussion. So with that, I would also like to thank you so much, Payal, for joining us. But before we close, we started with the same question and we also end with the same question. You mentioned a variety of different conferences that you will be joining and activities that lie ahead. Maybe in terms of research, what is something that you're working on right now that consumes your, let's say, academic capacity these days? What to expect next?
Well, we do have a data care festival coming up in June in Utrecht in Amsterdam, and we're bringing basically 80 impact leaders from all over the world, particularly the Global South, from five different sectors, from the creative to the sustainable and circular AI to feminist AI, building an alternative feminist ecosystem. And, you know, we're cutting across responsible AI in practice. And it's really speaking cross-disciplinary wise, but also across sectors. So we have Adobe, IKEA, to, you know, we have Nigerian content creators too. So we want to make sure that everybody are misfits and imposters. So nobody actually owns that space. And we are really doing this as a sort of, to me, academia needs those a change. And I'm fundamentally invested in that whatever we do is not for our echo chambers. It's like, oh, please, not another paper about how we're oppressed. Okay. Please. It's like more about let's get a seat at the table. Let's get uncomfortable. Let's put ourselves out there because we are publicly funded. We have the privilege to think deeply about these issues. And we need to be able to translate these issues into ways in which organizations outside of academia can use it for their purposes. This is a public service and we are public servants. And so that's what I'm doing. And this is more for a mission. And this is part of the Inclusive AI Lab that I've founded. So, you know, if any of the listeners are interested, I hope to see you in June. Else I will see you probably in Berlin and for the Design Up event, which I'll be speaking at, or maybe Republica in Berlin too.
I don't think there can be a better, let's say, wrap up and closing to this episode than what you just said. Let's get uncomfortable and think deeply about the conversation and the topics we touched. Payal, thank you so much for joining the Talking About Platforms podcast.
Thank you both. Appreciate it a lot.
Thank you so much, Payal.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.